Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Joe Nocera, an award-winning journalist and sports business columnist for the New York Times. He's previously written for Fortune, GQ, Esquire, and Texas Monthly. His latest book, Indentured, The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA, will be released today on February 16th, 2016, and it covers the fight of athletes against the current NCAA structure. It's a privilege to have you with us here today, Mr. Nocera.
Peter, please call me Joe, and thank you very much for having me.
Well, Joe, is there anything else you'd like to share about yourself so we can better get to know you before we dive in?
Well, I would say on this particular subject that I've been a sports fan my whole life. I grew up in Providence, so I rooted for the PC Friars and also most of the Boston professional teams. And as I've gotten older, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, I've really gotten interested in the NCAA and its structure and the problems that it creates for many, many athletes, college athletes, particularly those who are disadvantaged and black. So that's kind of my premise. And I've been writing about this subject on and off for about 5 years. And this book, Indentured, is sort of the culmination of that reporting. Obviously has a lot of additional reporting and a lot of additional stories. But it's kind of a summing up of where I stand on the issues.
Okay. Yeah, no, and this is an issue, obviously, that lots of people are interested in. We've had a couple podcast episodes about this already, one with Sonny Vaccaro, who was on and talked about his feelings. You know, I think his are similar to yours, from what I gather. And we also had Bernadette McGlade, who's the commissioner of the Atlantic 10 Conference, and her feelings are quite different. So obviously, people can look at this situation and come away with different interpretations of what's right and what's wrong with what's going on. But you've obviously done a lot of research and gotten a lot of takeaways from that.
Well, Sonny is a big character in my book. In some ways, he actually instigated the O'Bannon litigation. I mean, he had the idea, and he went to the lawyers, and he's the one who suggested that somebody ought to be suing the NCAA because of the way it deprives athletes of rights that every other American has as a matter of course, including the right to their image and likeness. So, let's be honest, I'm with Sonny. I strongly believe that college athletes are exploited, that even the thing they're promised, which is a real education, is often substandard or non-existent, and that they deserve to make some of the money that is allowing every single other person in the system to get rich off. A free labor force is the result of, let's face it, a cartel, and that's what the NCAA is.
Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that argument is easy to understand. You know, everybody's getting rich except for these players, and I think everybody sees that. Now you hear people argue, you know, players are compensated. It's not completely free, and you know, if that's true, it's not completely free. They do receive something. They receive a scholarship. They receive other incidental benefits. Why do you think those benefits are not sufficient compensation?
Sure, several reasons. The first is that the revenue-producing athletes, and that's what we're really talking about here, football and men's basketball players, are there on campus first and foremost to play their sport. The NCAA likes to pretend that playing a sport is just this ancillary activity, this extracurricular activity that students do. And we all know that that's BS. They have to work their academic schedule around their practice schedule. They miss tons of classes because they travel. There's actually no consideration given in the way the conferences are set up to minimize athlete travel and make it possible to spend more time in the classroom. So number one is they have a full-time job at the university, and that full-time job is to play their sport. And if they don't do that, or if they want to quit, or if it's too hard, or if they're not good enough, they'll lose their scholarship. The second reason is that the thing that they are supposed to be given, i.e. this education, is in many cases, especially for these revenue-producing athletes, completely substandard. And they may not be ready for college work, and college is not really capable of giving them what they need. And they often, you know, wind up, as I like to call it, majoring in eligibility. So they take random classes, gut classes, classes that everybody knows they're going to get a good grade in, even though they're not necessarily learning anything. And it's really a bad deal for them. Even the promise that is made to them, in my view, is way too often an unkept promise.
Okay, yeah, and you obviously see that in situations like the North Carolina academic fraud and stuff, where it's almost like they have to jump through these hoops, so they just create fake classes and things like that.
The idea that that only happened in North Carolina is, of course, ridiculous. You know, I mean, one of the reasons the Carolina scandal is so reverberates, and actually this is the subject of my column, the column I wrote last week. The reason it reverberates so much is because Carolina always had the image, the self-image, that it was better than that, that it didn't do stuff that you would expect at, you know, an SEC school, as a matter of course. So it's been kind of a traumatizing for North Carolina to realize that it, too, basically has corrupted its academic standards to keep athletes eligible.
Okay, yeah, that idea that nobody's perfect in this
right.
system.
It's almost impossible to be perfect in this system because you need 85 football players and then you need another 13 basketball players. And in order to field a really competitive and good football team, you often have to take players who went to lousy high schools or weren't that interested in academics and who really struggle and are unprepared for college-level work.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. Yeah, I think a lot of people listening to this will be familiar with the O'Bannon case, you know, with the Northwestern Union situation and things like that. Is there any issue or any person that you feel like has been underreported in the fight against the NCAA?
One of our major characters is a guy named Andy Schwartz. He's an economic litigation consultant on the West Coast. He and two other friends of his who are also both economic litigation consultants and who they all work together. One guy is named Dan Rasher. The other guy who's retired is named Ernie Nadell. They first had the idea, really around the year 2000, that the NCAA was vulnerable on antitrust grounds. And they ginned up something called the Jason White case. First, they wanted to do a case that would just kind of blow up the whole system and have the amateurism rules declared antitrust violations. But they couldn't get any lawyer to take that case. It's so hard to envision blowing up the system when you've been a fan your whole life and you just thought about it this way. So they eventually were able to get some lawyers to bring a case called the White case, which argued that players at a minimum should get their what's called the full cost of attendance, which is the difference between the scholarship and what it actually requires to go to college. The NCAA fought that tooth and nail. Ironically, today, cost of attendance is a normal part of what an athlete gets when he goes to college. And so from the White case evolved the O'Bannon case, and Schwartz and Rasher became the economic consultants for Michael Hausfeld, the lawyer who brought the case. And although they did not testify themselves, they helped prepare Roger Knowles' testimony. Roger Knowles, of course, is the Stanford sports economist who was the key economist for the O'Bannon side. And so they have been very, very deeply involved in this for the last 15 years. They've had a lot of ideas. They're deep believers that the market, if you had a free market for athletes, it would kind of sort itself out pretty quickly, just as it has in the professional sports. It would not, you know, break universities or anything like that. That is their belief. And so I think there are important figures in this movement who really haven't gotten their due.
Yeah, no, I mean, you see, one interesting thing about sports, I think a lot of people just view it fundamentally differently than other businesses. And people that are ardent free market people in every other situation in sports, they will fight it tooth and nail.
Right.
And I don't know exactly why that is, but yeah, I mean, it works in a lot of other situations. So
don't forget how fiercely Major League Baseball fought efforts to create free agency. You know, Curt Flood basically sacrificed his career for this. And, you know, there was all this talk. There was this widespread belief that free agency would destroy baseball. And not only did it not destroy baseball, it actually made the sport more prosperous and more popular than ever.
Right, yeah. And people talk about these huge salaries, you know, but the teams are still in business too. So
right. I mean,
it hasn't destroyed that system.
The NCAA argues that if you paid players, it would destroy the fabric of college sports. And I fundamentally don't believe that. I do think they need to be I think the core issue for fans is the knowledge that the players are, you know, university students. And I do think that there are ways that you could fix a curriculum to make it more adaptable for athletes. But that's a side issue. I don't think paying the players would make a whit of difference in terms of how fans reacted and how much they cared about college sports.
Yeah, no, I think I probably agree with that too. So, I guess before we wrap up, do you have any predictions about what would be the future of the NCAA with all these assaults coming against it? Is it going to fall apart and we won't have college sports anymore? Or it sounds like you think
Well,
something different than that, at
we're
least.
certainly going to have college sports. It's not going away. It's too popular. As my co-author Ben Strauss and I say in the book, when you take all the sports combined, they generate $13 billion in revenue. That's not going to go away. You know, ESPN paid, you know, something like $7.3 billion just for the rights to the new football playoffs. So it's not going to go away. There is new litigation, one brought by Jeff Kessler, who has brought tons of litigation over the years against the NFL in particular and helped create NFL free agency. He has got a lawsuit that argues that now that we know that the NCAA amateurism rules are in violation of the antitrust law, that those rules need to go away and that the NCAA should simply not have anything to do with compensating athletes, and that it should be up to the schools and the conferences to decide whether they want to pay an athlete or not. That is the most important and the most threatening piece of litigation that the NCAA faces today. There's a small possibility that the O'Bannon case might go to the Supreme Court. The deadline for that, for them to ask for that, is mid-March. But finally, a lot of people on the O'Bannon side are disappointed with the result, because even though they were shown to be in violation of the antitrust laws, none of the judges, either at the federal court level or at the appeals court level, were willing to take the next logical step and say, well, since the rules violate the law, we got to get rid of the rules. Instead, they have, in effect, allowed the NCAA to continue setting the compensation or lack thereof for athletes. So the only way you're really, really going to force change, at least in the short term, is if, you know, you had a Final Four and one of the teams didn't come out. If athletes were to pick up on what happened in Missouri this past fall when players temporarily went on strike over issues of racism on campus, and the president resigned within 36 hours. Athletes do have power. It's hard for 18 and 19-year-olds to use that power because they are so, you know, they have their whole lives ahead of them and they don't want to do anything to jeopardize a professional career, which they all think they were going to have. And because it's just, you know, a hard thing to do to kind of stand up like that and be counted. So will that ever happen? I don't know. But, you know, certainly in my fondest dreams, that would be what happens and that would change the system almost instantly.
Yeah, and it would definitely provide a lot of topics for newspaper columnists to write about as well.
Well, that's for
So,
sure. That's for damn sure. Yeah. I'd be all over it.
yeah, no, and I'd be reading them for sure. That would be a very interesting situation. So, yeah, no, I think we'll be talking about this stuff for a long time, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, who has a voice in this discussion and whether athletes participate in it in that way. So, yeah, no, I think that's very interesting.
Anyway, I thank you very much. I appreciate this. I enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, yeah, no, it's great to have you on, and if people want to read more about this, they can get your book. It's entitled Indentured: The Inside Story of the Rebellion Against the NCAA.
Thanks so much,
So,
Peter. Take care.
yeah, thanks for coming on.
Bye-bye.
I'll see you.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz Podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Lieb Montoya for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.